From WBUR Boston, this is Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Deborah Becker. Each week, we bring you the best of Boston University from the worlds of scholarship, letters, politics, and the arts. Tonight, we present the second of three installments from the annual lecture series, The Fascination with Jewish Tales, by teacher, author, and Nobel Peace Prize winner Elie Wiesel. Tonight's lecture is titled In Hasidism, Reb Leib Soares and His Mysterious Powers. Introducing Professor Wiesel is the director of the B'nai B'rith Hillel Foundation, Rabbi Joseph Pollack.
17th century European Jewry had been seduced by a false messiah who, when he converted to Islam, broke every Jewish heart from Amsterdam to Minsk. There were child marriages in those days, or at least engagements, because if you were neither wealthy nor a Torah scholar, marrying off your child was next to impossible. The teaching of children, the Jewish educational system, was a pedagogic disaster. It bred ignorant Jews whose ignorance was transmitted from one generation to another, yet the only admired Jews were the scholars. Jews started hating themselves. They lost hope. And the pogroms of Khmelnytsky, involving the wanton slaughter of thousands of innocent Jewish men, women, and children, did nothing to heighten Jewish pride. And then suddenly, the sun rose. A little boy was born. Israel, they called him. The holy Baal Shem Tov, master of the good name. Slowly, slowly, deliberately, he restored the good name to his people. He taught that every human being was precious, and without disparaging it, he taught that there was more to life than scholarship. He taught that the destiny of the Jewish people lay in its capacity to be holy and pure and honest. His involvement was with simple folk, whose greatness he always exposed, and his paths to the service of God had to do with joy and peace. He was an organizer, and he created disciples, one of whom was Reb Leib Soares. Like his great teacher, Reb Leib wandered about the Carpathians and bumped into people and asked them questions that changed them, and taught them Torah that transformed them. And then sometime later, in the 20th century, by burning and by drowning, by starvation and by disease, an evil man, attended by evil societies, murdered 6 million Jews. The shattered survivors, unsteady on their feet, haunted by screams and nightmares, could make no sense of their experience, and sometimes ask God, whatever became of those divine promises about rescuing his people in every generation. Many had lost any capacity for consolation, and they turned their eyes away from holy texts. And here too, the sun started to rise, and a young man by the name of Elie Wiesel, whose eyes had seen the slaughter and who firmly asked God fearless questions, this very same man told the tattered remnants of world Jewry that there was, in fact, consolation, and that consolation could be found in the text. And he came to Boston University, and he began teaching the text again and again, now for 32 years, and no one can get enough of it. Ladies and gentlemen, Elie Wiesel.
He was no orator, no teacher, no thinker. How is one to comprehend his tremendous appeal to popular Hasidic fantasy. Although he wasn't known for the width of his erudition or the depth of his thoughts, is it because of that? Because as a person, as an individual, he transcended what we usually call learning and knowledge. Because shrouded in mystery, he was not known for anything except his very secret powers. He is not my favorite. I have spoken here for the last 32 years about the very great masters of the movement, and they all had extraordinary talent. This one, I don't know what his talent was. Furthermore, all the other masters I've spoken about had written books, or so many books written about them. This one, there are no sources. It is as if he tried to challenge me and say, look, you will have nothing. Do something with it. So today, we are going to tell stories, quite simply stories, most marvelous in their simplicity, in their almost childlike naivete, stories from the Hasidic orchard, all of them marked by miracles from which were inseparable. All those stories are inseparable from Hasidism. Elsewhere, in a novel, an author stated, God made man because he loves stories. He who? Man or God? That is a story in itself. In Hasidic literature, as we know, storytelling remains an essential part, endowed with quasi-mystical grace of the Hasidic experience. Telling the story to one is like studying the Zohar to another. So, in truth, we shall continue our exploration, but first let me thank Rabbi Pollack, my old and eternally young friend, who is extraordinary here at Hillel, at Boston University, making it one of the best Hillel houses and Hillel centers in the country. But then, isn't Boston University one of the best universities in the country? I love to study Talmudic and biblical commentaries with him, always discovering something new, something exciting, and something creative. And I like listening to him except when he talks about me. Shall we begin? Once upon a time in a small town called Rovno in Tsarist Russia, there was a poor grade school teacher, a melamed as we called him. In his 60s already, he earned a living, 50 dinars annually, which is almost nothing, even more than a salary here at our university. He was working for an employer, for the local lord, a Jewish innkeeper, whose children, as well as other children in the village, were his pupils of religion. From time to time, he filled the role of shochet, performing the ritual involved in slaughtering chickens. He was often seen in the forest, meditating in silence. Alone and solitary, Rabbi Yosef, as his name was a widower. Shortly after the marriage, his first wife died young from a violent illness. Since then, he lived on the fringes of society. He spoke little, was never trusting, allied himself with no one, trying not to draw any attention. And the years went by slowly, smoothly. Yes, he had already turned 60 when his life changed. Here is what happened. In the house, among the children, there was a young girl, smart, wholesome, and quite beautiful. Sarah was her name. She was so attractive that a young Christian, son of the local lord, fell hopelessly in love with her. And losing control over the passion now become obsession, he confessed it to her, all while having promised her a glorious and happy future with him. And he swears that unable to live without her, He would do whatever it takes, good or evil, to win her over. So as she resisted his advances, he threatened her, she and her loved ones, that they would pay dearly for the shame that they were inflicting upon him. That very night, the innkeeper held a family meeting which was attended by friends and neighbors. They all felt threatened. Naturally, Sarah was present. In silence, she listened to the discussion, sad. Should she be sent somewhere? If humiliated, the lord of the village would end up taking revenge on the family for not finding the object of his unfortunate son's love. She recalled a similar story that she had previously heard from the very mouth of the old teacher about the young girl from Nemirov. Also beautiful, quite appealing. Her parents had been assassinated in a pogrom of which Rabbi Polak spoke, Khmelnytsky pogroms. She alone was saved. The leader of the savage mob deemed her too beautiful to die, to live without him. While on board of a small boat, on the way to the church where he was going to force her to marry him, she jumped into the water and drowned. What could they do? Hearts written with anguish, faces revealing their helplessness, parents and guests alike were silent, defeated. It is at this moment that Sarah's voice was heard. She had a solution, and not the same as in Nemirov. I must get married, she said. Only marriage could save her. Her and everyone else. Right away, that very night. To whom? Exclaimed her father. Where might I go to find you an honorable fiancé from a good family, someone worthy of you? Without a word, she pointed to Reb Yosef, the old teacher. And amidst the commotion that ensued, she explained, the smitten young man will be ashamed to tell his father that the girl of his dreams is a married woman, the wife of a 60-year-old man. And after a while, he will find a way to forget the whole affair. Hasidic legend adds as well, the father succeeded in quickly assembling 10 men for the ceremony, but none knew the necessary prayers. And so it was the fiancé himself, the groom himself, who recited the prayers, something unusual and extremely rare. Moreover, the looming question whether the fiancé has the right to officiate at his own marriage is discussed in several works by decision makers. The oldest, by a certain Rabbi Avraham Hayarchi, is against it. The reason? Too preoccupied or moved by the ceremony, the fiancé would be incapable of concentrating. No. On the other hand, according to Hasidic legend, the great Rebbe Tzvi Hersch HaKohen of Liminov had himself done this very thing. He performed the ceremony at his own wedding. But it was hardly underway when the bride interrupted and said to her father, I do not consent to this marriage before I am promised and blessed by someone worthy to have a child, by my groom. Well, there was nobody. So her fiancé gave her the blessing that she will have a child from him. Later on, she admitted to him that for years she had secretly watched him. She knew that he was not a simple man he seemed to be, that he moved in celestial circles superior and inaccessible to common people and mere mortals. The end thus is very happy. It's a happy end in Hasidism, because this very young girl saved her honor and the lives of those close to her by marrying an older man. God rewarded them with a son who would become one of the great miracle makers of Hasidism, Reb Leib Soris. After her great-grandfather, Reb Leib, better known as the Maharal of Prague. If this latter man was a great scholar, the Maharal, and known worldwide, the former, Reb Leib Soris, did everything not to be. He was a tzaddik nistar, as we called him, a righteous, just man, but a hidden master, secret, impenetrable, always living in mystery. Yet the two great men shared something else in common, the same concern to come to the aid of their people whenever there was such a need. And to do so, they each had access to very unique means. We used the word miracle earlier. Let's stop for a moment to reflect, as we must. After all, each of the Hasidic masters we have evoked for their work and destiny during the past 32 years were known not only for their specific teachings, but also for the fact that they performed miracles for all those who came to request intercession from above in the heavens. As a child, I believed in miracles, and I believed in them with such confidence, such belief, that it made me happy. And at times I was at peace with myself, knowing that somebody can correct injustices. If things happen and I don't like them, a miracle will occur. I will like what I have. Now, under the weight of years, I know that it's not so easy. When we needed miracles, there were none to be had. Actually, the miracle as an element in religious consciousness does not receive unanimous acceptance in ancient texts. For sure, the Bible is full of them, and the books of the prophets as well. The 10 plagues in Egypt, the crossing of the Red Sea. What would the Book of Books be without these divine interventions in favor of God's people and their leaders? But there it is God who wishes for these miracles. People do have the right and perhaps even the obligation to want them and to beg for them. But that's all. In the Talmud, we find passages in which such and such a sage is reprimanded for having performed a miracle, saying things like, a man has no right to change the laws of creation, so willed by the Creator himself. Rabbi Akiba, Rabbi Meir, Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai had received the gift of Ruach HaKodesh, a kind of spiritual wisdom and power. The Holy Spirit took hold of them and allowed them to see invisible beings and objects. What about in daily life as well? Yes. And in every tangible ways. Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus changed the course of a river. Choni HaMa'agal brought an end to drought. Rabbi Yochanan, with his stare, killed Rabbi Kahana. But don't worry, he raised him from the dead. Later, Rabbi Yosef Karu, the author of the Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Behavior, was visited in his dreams by a magi, the preacher, who dictated his teachings to him. So, he also told the Rebbe, by the way, the preacher told Rabbi Yosef Karu that he would be in a position to perform miracles as great as those in the Bible. Indeed, all these tales are told in our texts, but we do not pride ourselves on having provoked or deserved them. Oh yes, we certainly do find plenty of miracles on almost every page in the Bible. Four terms describe them. Otot umoftim, nisim veniflaot. Otot are signs or signals that carry a higher meaning. They require interpretation in order to grasp the meaning and hidden beauty of these events. Moftim are supernatural acts which need hardly any interpretation. They are miraculous. A miraculous Rebbe is called Balm of Faith, a man of wonders and miracles. The same difference goes for the two other words, nisim veniflaot. Nisim are astonishing actions or events that undeniably strike us by their miraculous nature. But niflaot are normal-looking gestures and words coming from everyday life. The way in which the Rebbe ties his shoelaces, the way he eats, the way he drinks, the way he prays, or the way he is silent, are already niflaot, wonders. For all four categories, it is imperative that the Hasid be present. Even more so, that he be capable or worthy of appreciating what he sees, what she hears, at its true value. Yet what happens if he is not capable of it, if he is not ready? After all, let's remember, one of the spiritually privileged and rare moments in Scripture happens at Sinai, when the people of Israel readied themselves to receive the law. Lightning and thunder preceded this event. For what reason? To illustrate the spectacular aspect of this scene? No. The Midrash supplies us with a much simpler and disconcerting reason. God used thunder and lightning to wake his people, to pull them from the deep slumber into which they had fallen. Now, can this be true? For the first and only time in history, God was going to address his people directly, without any messenger, without any intermediary, without any prophet. And they were sleeping? Yes, the descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the followers of Moses and Aaron, were sleeping. It's possible to live through great events and not be affected by them. As for Niflaot, which allows a Hasid to admire, to adore his Rebbe, let us say simply, woe is our generation. It has lost the meaning of adoration. We don't know whom or how to adore. Who do young people adore today? In Hasidism, where miracles occupy a place of honor, wasn't it the best to show the way? Certain masters were opposed to them. The very great Rabbi Mendel of Kotsk, Heschel calls him the Kierkegaard of Hasidism. He interpreted the verse of Ototum of Timbe at Marpane Ham, thanking God for the miracles performed in the land of Ham, he said, in the following way. It is there in the land of Ham, he said. It is in there that they belong, not here. He said, forget miracles. Who wants miracles? He said also, quote, he who believes in man-made miracles is stupid, but he who doesn't is a miscreant. I remember in my town in Sigit in the Carpathian Mountains, where I grew up, an old woman often screamed, oh God, she said, please, make it so that our enemies should depend on miracles. We always needed miracles to survive. But each Hasidic master to whom such powers were attributed possessed other virtues. Some distinguished themselves in their studies, others by their prayer or devotion, still others by their song or by their silence. Reb Leib Sores is different. He did not establish a system, nor did he hold court. He did not create a school. He did not write anything. We know him solely for his fantastic experiences and incredible exploits, all to aid Jews who were sick, poor, or in peril. And all he was able to accomplish was, therefore, miraculous. But then, why the reverence? Because the people needed a man like him, too. They needed teachers who knew. They needed teachers who had feelings. They needed teachers who could show them the way. But they also needed people like him who performed miracles. Because in those times, Jews had no rights whatever. They had to buy protection. Their freedom, their life hinged on the goodwill of local squires who exploited their commercial talents. After all, what was Hasidism then? You heard it from Rabbi Polak. Thanks to the Besht, the Baal Shem Tov, Hasidism was the most revolutionary movement in Judaism. It excited the young, stimulated the dreamers, the poor, the desperate, the defeated. The elite also came to join later. And this can be seen by the quality of the Besht's early companions. They were all great, renowned scholars. They too had felt that Hasidism was accomplishing something vital, something necessary for Jewish continuity. It was offering hope to the hopeless and a sense of belonging to those who needed it. The uprooted, isolated, impoverished, and uneducated villagers who, due to conditions not of their making, lived on the edge of history and even outside its boundaries and suddenly they felt linked to the people, to the destiny of Israel. The force of the movement lay not in ideology, but in life. Hasidism changed the climate and the quality of Jewish life in the hundreds of hamlets. And therefore, in that tormented and torn 18th century, when the Jews suffered more than their neighbors, they were victims not only of the aggressors, but of their fellow victims as well. In that era of upheavals, what did a simple Jewish villager need most? He simply needed someone to bring him or her hope. And what Rabbi Leib Sofes did, with his imagination, he brought them hope. How did he manage to stay informed of all the problems that individual Jews had to face? Well, of course, as we said earlier, by the Ruach HaKodesh, by the gift of clairvoyance bestowed on the chosen ones by the Spirit of Holiness. This was naturally a rare gift, but less rare among the great Hasidic masters. This being said, Reb Leib's gift is of a completely different nature and more remarkable. Legend says that he was a master in the art of what we call Kfitzat HaDerech, which means he was able to shorten distances. In 1 hour, he visited villages separated by 100 kilometers. I exaggerate, but so did he. But Reb Leib Sofes did even better. Legend describes him as Roe Veino Nireh. Someone who sees but is not seen. Rabbi Leib also showed up often in various and faraway places looking for errant souls in need of a tikkun, of a repair, of redemption, in order to find a place in the world of truth. For his travels, or to enter into exile, or to pay ransom for hostages and prisoners, he brought along 3 objects, a big stick, a beggar's pouch, and smell powder. He used the stick to chase away evil spirits, the pouch to collect the suffering of Israel, and the powder for the Sabbath to revigorate the faith of tired souls. Strangely enough, in the Middle Ages, the alchemists, we are told, have tried to develop the same thing, how to become invisible. It's memory. As an adolescent, over there in the nocturnal kingdom where evil and death reigned as gods, smile if my naivete makes you, I sometimes thought of Rabbi Leib with nostalgia. There were surely among us the condemned, some lamedvovnik, some secret, hidden, just man. Those who were wise and compassionate, hidden or future righteous ones. Where was he, Rabbi Leib, or someone like him to come save them through the barbed wire by teaching us how to become invisible? Another story. The Besht, the Baal Shem Tov, is sick in his bed, surrounded by his faithful disciples. From time to time he speaks to them. All of them know he's close to the end. He died at the age 60. His soul burns to leave the body to go join his ancestors above. Suddenly a stranger appears, an emaciated man with a fraught face. A few remember seeing him when he was still a teenager. Having just arrived, he begins to pace the house of study, deep in concentration, without paying any attention to those who want him out. But the Besht, the sick man in bed, forbids them from chasing him. Why did the Besht show such tenderness? Why did the founder, the creator of the movement, show such sympathy, such friendliness for someone completely unknown and so young? No one knows. No one ever sought to know. But here, at the end of the Besht's life, he is coming to the bedside, holding his hand out to the sick teacher. They look at each other for quite some time. the visitor with sadness and the master with joy. Then they exchanged several words that no one heard. It is said that the sick Besht conferred on him his favorite because little known mission to take care of the 36 legendary righteous ones, the Lamed Vavniks, thanks to whom the world is able to survive. This is why he went regularly to fairs, looking in the crowds here and there for one of them to meet their needs. Because the hidden righteous ones claim to be simple, poor, insignificant, no one should ever discover their secret. In any case, once the brief conversation with the Besht was over, the visitor nodded his head as a sign of consent and went away. And the Besht declared in his soft voice to his disciples, "That young man walks on a razor's edge, but all that he is doing, he does for the honor of God. Few know him, but I know who he is. He fasts the entire week, not to punish his body, but absorbed in lofty meditation, he simply forgets to eat." And it was the Bleib Soes, the Bleib son of Sarah. Why his name? Shortly before his death, Rabbi Yosef remembered the old teacher who married a young girl. So his father called his son and told him, "Do you know what is more solid than the rock, more clear than crystal, more pure than you? I'll tell you, your mother Sarah. So I advise you to add her name to your own." And so he became the Bleib son of Sarah. Now, problem is, as I said, we know so little about him. From the legend around his birth, what do we know of him? He was born in 1730, 6 years before the Besht's revelation as the first founding master of the movement. Everything about him is mysterious, only legends. He was badly dressed and sloppy looking. He could have been taken for a porter or a peasant. He had two sons, neither of whom became rabbis. Now, what do we know about this fascinating character? My response owes much to the already mentioned Reb Maimon and to the work of a man named Nirman, a direct descendant of Reb Leib Soes. Yes, he was born in 1730 on the 17th day of the month of Tammuz. At the age of 60, like the Besht, he died in the village of Yalshkov, where he was buried in a simple tomb with a straw-covered roof, without the traditional ohel or barrack or tent that one usually sees with great masters. Thus, the commentary of Rabbi Avraham Yeshua Heschel of Apt, the famous Rav of Apt, "As in life, Reb Leib Soes has a disdain for honors in death as well. He loved to recite prayers in silence. He spent Rosh Hashanah far from his home and kept an orphan close to him while officiating for the evening service. But this orphan did once make the mistake of speaking ill of the Besht's grandson. After that, Reb Leib Soes stopped seeing him. According to a Hasidic legend, the Maggid of Meserich gave him as a gift the soul of Chaim ben Attar, the Besht's faithful friend, the great commentator of the Bible, as a gift for his bar mitzvah. And this excerpt is from a letter signed by the great Maggid of Meserich himself. I quote him, "Reb Yehuda Leib, son of Reb Yosef, known as Reb Leib Soes of Rovno, is involved in a mitzvah, a good deed that none other may surpass. It is not possible to speak of it in writing. Those among you who listen to me, those among you who follow me, I ask you to help him, to support him with all your means. I have witnessed his activities, and I attest that they are all above suspicion, that there is nothing unclean in their intent. And he who understands will understand." Will understand what? The Maggid of Meserich does not say. But what is clear and indisputable is the esteem in which he holds him with all his authority. At that time, the Maggid of Meserich was the number one. He had the whole movement in his hand. He had the moral and spiritual authority to guarantee, and he guaranteed the conduct of Rabbi Leib Soes. Was Leibsovers doing dangerous things because they were illegal? Or mystical and thus incomprehensible to laymen? What was it exactly that the Margit was asking their help for? We don't know. On this subject at least, Rabbi Leibs himself, who helped so many people, doesn't help me. Did he have a brother, Rabbi Mordechai? Some say so. Some even go far as to speak highly of his qualities, but it remains uncertain. At a very young age, he lost his father. It was his mother, a young widow, who raised him. So when was the miracle maker's period of his life miraculous? Some texts put it during the reign of King Joseph II of Austria, with, or rather against whom, he led a bitter and relentless fight. The object of their disagreement, the sovereign had commanded, he had commanded all the Jewish communities in Europe to accept secular education to be given to their children. And this law made many Jewish leaders concerned, including the Hasidic world, their fear purely spiritual. Exposing children to exterior influences, they thought, would risk opening them to the dangers of assimilation. History retained their efforts, proclamations of fasting and penitence days, calling on the heavens to help them repeal the nefarious decree, visits from rabbinical delegations to the royal palace, and their failures and other efforts. But in legend, Rabbi Leib Soares played a dramatic role. Certain legends describe him as a sort of James Bond. He traveled at the speed of wind, and even more rapidly than the wind, to wherever he was needed. And he supposedly had met the king in situations both diverse and barely believable, as you will see, unless you are Hasidic, and then you believe everything. Though never invited, he appeared where he was not expected. Some claim that the Austrian sovereign was afraid of him. Their unique, quote, relationship lasted 10 years of hostility until the subject of the story, not Rabbi Leib, the king died. One more story. This one is a bit longer, but it's true or not. One day in the company of his friend, Rabbi Azriel, Leibsovers left for Vilna, or Vilnius, 3 kilometers away from the town. They stopped at an inn owned by a Jew who was rich because he sold cheap shlivovitz. His inn was therefore full all the time. The day after they arrived, the Leib asked Rabbi Azriel to see if the innkeeper would come to see him. The innkeeper came. "Go to the prince's palace," said Rabbi Leib, "on the street of the Gentiles, and tell the prince that the Jew Leib, son of Sarah, is in your inn, and ask that he come immediately." The innkeeper started to laugh. "Do you take me for a fool? A Jew entering the palace is never sure to get out alive. The prince is the son of kings. He has never spoken to a Jew. How could I, an innkeeper, dare to go to him and simply tell him that the Jew is asking that the prince come to see him?" The innkeeper went home and told the whole story to his wife. She must have further encouraged him in his refusal because he came back to see the Leib and said, "Please, I beg you, go away. Go away, don't pay for your lodging, don't pay for the shlivovitz, go away, nothing bad will happen to me. And because of you, nothing will happen to anyone." The Leib reprimanded him upon hearing this. "Do you know who I am? I am Leib Soares. If you do not obey me, you'll be sorry for it." In the hour that followed, the innkeeper's wife and the two sons became ill. He hurried to the rabbi and told him, "My wife and sons are dying. They are sick. Help. I'll do anything you wish. But take back the curse." "Go quickly to see the prince," said the rabbi, "and your wife and sons will immediately be cured." His heart heavy and full of anguish, the fellow went to the palace, thinking, "If I die, may my death save the lives of my loved ones." But nothing had happened to him. He knocked on the palace door. An escort came out and asked him what he was doing there. "I must see the prince," said the Jew. The escort consulted other servants. They were all puzzled. In the meantime, the prince arrived, and they told him what was happening. "There's a Jew outside who wants to see him." "Bring him in," commanded the prince. "Lord," said the innkeeper, I came because there's a Jew in my tavern. His name is Leib, son of Sarah. And he said that I should tell you that he summons you to come to see him immediately. As soon as the visitor mentioned the name of the Rebbe, the prince's whole body began to shiver and his face changed colors. I'm coming, he repeated. I'm quickly getting dressed and I'm coming. And the prince ordered his servants to bring his outfit. Once dressed, he left the palace and sent away his carriage. He followed the innkeeper on foot. In the street, soldiers wanted to salute him, according to custom and protocol. But he gestured to them to do nothing. He insisted on being alone with the Jew. The carriage followed behind them. Once they arrived at the inn, the Jew went to inform the Rebbe that the prince was there. Go see your loved ones, said the Rebbe. You'll see they are doing better. Then go tell the prince to be patient. Let him wait. I'll come and see him. The meeting took place soon thereafter. It lasted only several minutes. And the Leib Soros told Rabbi Azriel that they had to leave right away. As for the prince, back at the palace, he was overtaken with astonishment. He didn't understand why, upon hearing the name Leib, son of Sarah, he was gripped by a sense of fright. He sent his soldiers to the inn to bring him back at once, but he was no longer there. The innkeeper informed them that he had just left an hour earlier. End of story. Of course, it begs a number of questions. Why did the Rebbe insist on meeting the prince? What was he preparing to speak with him about? Why the secrecy? And why, really, why punishing the innkeeper? Why making his family sick? Was it to save a human soul, a lost community? And why hadn't he allowed his companion, Rabbi Azriel, to attend the meeting? Why did he want to be alone with the prince? Why had they left it out with such haste, as if in flight? Was the Leib Soros afraid of the prince's anger or vengeance once the latter awoke from his traumatic moment? As with everything concerning him, these questions remain unanswered. It is as if everything in him suggested or imposed enigma or secrecy. If not, the forbidden. The story itself is enough. Every hypothesis creates a situation. Almost every Hasidic master from the first or second generation possessed and presented an aspect of his personality which remains obscure, that is natural. No one reveals himself fully. No Hasid can know everything about his Rebbe. It would even be arrogant to try. Who could, who would dare to understand what the deep sorrow of the Becht hid during the last year? Or the motives that provoked the seer of Lublin's fall? Or the long isolation which lasted 20 years of Rabbi Menachem Mendel of Kotsk? Or moreover, the bottomless melancholy in which Rabbi Nachman of Bratslav sometimes wallowed but never stopped struggling against? It's even more striking with Rabbi Leib Soros. At least with the others, we have some points of reference, be it in their biographical or pseudo-biographical stories, or the biblical or rabbinic commentaries, or in their aphorisms. Some texts reading these figures astonish with their clarity, but not with Rabbi Leib Soros. All there is about him lurks in shadow. We really don't know what he does, why he does it, and why he keeps it from the view of others as well. We don't know what is attractive or what is revolting to him. It is as everything in him, in all the fragments of his being, is trying to call us to the imaginary. In other words, to move us, to make us dream. For the story we have just told is not complete. It's not the end of the story. Far from it. It continues in the same village, not far from Vilno, and in the same inn. Soon before Passover or Pesach, the Christian servant of the story, of the story's Jewish innkeeper, disappeared without a trace. Whereupon the local priests were quick to accuse the innkeeper of having him murdered to use his blood for the matzah. The prisoner was submitted to torture that became unbearable, and at which end he declared himself guilty. And he was condemned to death. The only detail missing to carry out his execution was the prince's approval. And the letter indicated he would give it, but first he must bring the convict under strong guard to the fair in town to help with the purchase of horses, because according to the prince, it was the convict's specialty. He was a horse merchant. And suddenly, right in the middle of the fair, the innkeeper, the convict, the prisoner, noticed his servant who had disappeared, who, upon seeing the innkeeper, came running to him. And he told him his sad story. It was the priest who was responsible. He convinced the servant to go far, far away, where he would receive his own house and some land too, and the servant refused. The priest kept remounting the attack. Finally, he arranged for the servant to be kidnapped. And since then, he wandered from place to place without the means to leave, with no money for the voyage. Otherwise, he would have returned long ago to his employer. Last night, he said, an old Jew with his escort put him in his carriage and brought him here. And the old man told me that it is here at the fair that I would find you. The prince did not understand that the innkeeper was innocent. He was still not aware that the servant was the one who had disappeared. On the way back, the prince turned to the innkeeper and said to him, "Do you remember the visit to me at the palace?" "Yes," the innkeeper remembered. "Do you remember that you led me to an old Jew?" He did recall. "When I was alone with him, do you know what he told me?" "No," the innkeeper did not know. "Well, I'm going to tell you," he said. "When we were alone, he told me that he had a favor to ask of me. When I would be presented for my approval with a death sentence against you, I was to answer that I first must bring you to the fair where they sell horses in Vilno." It's at this moment that the innkeeper points to his servant and reveals his identity to him. "At the time," said the prince, "I understood nothing about the old Jew's request. Now I understand it, and I thank the God of Israel for having sent his emissaries, gifted with the power to prevent me from committing a flagrant and unforgivable injustice." This time, the story finished happily. The innkeeper gained his freedom and happiness once again, and the servant his work. It is the priest who was put in prison. And all this thanks to the legendary figure who was anywhere, a man or woman on the brink, needed someone to prove that he or she is innocent, or that she or he is not alone, forgotten, abandoned. The Hasidic philosopher Aaron Marcus relates the following incident. In 1774, in a small village, a peasant slapped his small 2-year-old boy so hard that he began to bleed and he lost consciousness. Thinking he was dead, the father threw the body into the courtyard of a house which belonged to a Jew, which happened again very frequently. Jews will tell you that when on Passover Eve, when we say the Haggadah, we recite the story of the Exodus, at one point we stop and we send the youngest to the door to open the door to invite Prophet Elijah to come in, and then we say Shvoch HaMatcha, a special prayer. The real reason why they did it in the Middle Ages was to see if there is no dead child at the door. And so it happened there. The Jew was imprisoned, and the community was seized with fear. A crowd gathered in the public square, surrounding the body, preaching hate for the Jews. It is at this moment that Reb Leib Sores appeared, out of nowhere. In the front of everyone began to speak to the child. And to the astonishment of the crowd, the child replied by describing the blows and wounds that his father had inflicted upon him. And this story was relayed to Pope Clement XIV in Rome, who, completely shocked, made a public decree denouncing once and for all Christian accusations of ritual murder against the Jews in Christian territories. Strange, a variation of the same theme appeared in Yemen, not far from Sana'a. There lived a Rebbe, Shalom Alchibizi ben Yosef, a tzaddik miracle maker as well, just like Rebbe Leib Sores. He too devoted his life to freeing Jews from their prison. He too entered royal palaces without guards being able to prevent him. It is said that he punished them with such force that they stopped persecuting the unfortunate Jews. Now an amusing story. Reb Leib arrived one night in a Hungarian village near the town of Kalev. Kalev, the Rebbe, was known for his beautiful Hungarian chants. And usually what he did, he would go into the fields, listening to the shepherds. And he would buy from the shepherd a song, a love song. And he would buy it for money. But the moment he bought it, the shepherd forgot it. And the song then became a love song between him and God. So he came to the Hungarian village. He knocked at the door of a Jewish farmer and asked him to go wake the village lord and tell him that Leib, son of Sarah, awaits him at the door. As the Jew knew that the village lord was well known for his hot temper, he dared not obey. "The Lord may very well shoot me," he said. The rabbi told him not to be afraid because he would live to the ripe age of 120. The farmer woke the lord, who went to meet the rabbi. And the rabbi's blessing did indeed bear its fruit. He lived for a long time. At the age of 114, he became angry when his 80-year-old son announced to him that he was going to marry a poor young woman. She was too young for him. And the farmer slapped his son and said to him, "How dare you to get married and have children at your age? And who is going to take care of them when you die?" Well, I spoke about ritual murder. Ritual murder nevertheless continued in Syria. It continued in Hungary. Even in Hungary, I remember as a child singing a song about Tisza Eszláv, one of the last ritual murders, Tisza Eszláv, and of course in Russia, the Bylist trial. Now, to my embarrassment and fear and shame, it's still being shown on television. Syrian and Egyptian televisions show a lot of stories now accusing Jews of ritual murder, and they show it literally on television. No wonder that hatred exists, always based on lies. Reb Leib performed another miracle at an inn where a fire broke out. Everyone was worried and screamed, but he remained deep in meditation. When it became too dangerous, people shook him, begging him to do something. He asked for a bottle. He went to the well and filled it, and he dumped it on the fire, and the fire went out. On one occasion, the day before Yom Kippur, he found himself in a small town where few Jews lived. In fact, there weren't even enough to make up a minyan of 10 men for the communal prayer. There were only 9, and time was short. The hour to recite Kol Nidre was approaching. Where to find a tenth man? Already in his talit, his prayer shawl and kittel, he prayed for a miracle in vain. "Perhaps there is a Jew in the neighboring village," asked Reb Leib Soris. "No, no one," he was told. Reb Leib continued, "Perhaps someone was converted to Christianity." "Oh yes, there was, he was told, the lord of the village. He had converted 40 years earlier to be able to marry his predecessor's daughter, who had fallen in love with him. "Where does he live?" asked Reb Leib. They pointed out the palace to him. He took off his prayer shawl, but not his white kittel, and robed in white ran to see the Lord, who opened the door to him. They looked at each other for some time in silence. Then the visitor began to speak. "I am Leib, son of Sarah. I knew Rabbi Israel Bar Shem Tov, the master of the good name. My mother was a beautiful and pure woman who sanctified the name of Israel. This is the evening of the holy day, the most holy day of the year, Yom Kippur. So I am here to invite you to come with me so that we may have a minyan, a quorum, to recite the solemn blessing, prayer, Kol Nidre." Several moments later, the door to the house of prayer opened with a great flourish, and the two men arrived out of breath. Reb Leib had a prayer shawl given to the Lord and had two old holy parchments of the Torah taken, one for him and one for the Lord. It was Rabbi Leib himself who started into the solemn and melodious Kol Nidre prayer, which is supposed to cancel out the vows and sermons offered by mistake or against one's will. And the Lord released a painful scream that shook all those present. Other miracles, his human life is full of them. Hasidism abounds with these marvelous and enchanting tales where, thanks to the intervention of a good, righteous, and charitable man, thanks to a word or a gesture, hope is reborn and joy too. because the impossible becomes possible and the unreal so real. Happy are those who believe in this. For me, everything in life comes back to a miracle. A child's smile, a shepherd's melody, the birth of friendship, the happiness in being able to console, comfort, teach, learn, help, love, pray, or just of being together with people who listen or who speak or who sing. I am not among those who like Hasidim on account of its miracles. I love Hasidism for its warmth, for the authenticity of its fervor, its depth, its stories. In other words, Hasidism is not just a collection of miracles, but they are also part of it. In 1790, the Blaib came to celebrate Yom Kippur at the home of Rabbi Pinchas of Koretz, the great friend and disciple of the Baal Shem Tov. At the conclusion of the feast, they shut themselves in Rabbi Pinchas' room, from which he later accompanied the visitor with tears in his eyes and said, "What can I do, since it's your will to be first?" Several months later, the Blaib Soris died, and King Joseph II followed him later. Before leaving this world, Rabbi Leib spoke of neither his own life nor his own experiences, but spoke these words, which were his last, and they demonstrate his humility. He was humble to the end. All of a sudden, he said, "The Magen Avraham, Abraham's shield, the important book of commentaries, but Rabbi Avraham Abeli of Kalish was a true genius, an authentic Kabbalist, and he was a real tzaddik, and he rendered his soul to his creator." In conclusion, why was he so revered? By simple people, we would understand. No, he was revered by masters, by great masters, by their learned disciples. They speak about him with deep respect and admiration and affection. Why? Because of his stories, because of his miracles, because he appeals to our sense of wonder, or because simply we need him. Thank you.
You've just heard the second of three lectures in the annual series, The Fascination with Jewish Tales, by teacher, author, and Nobel Peace Prize winner Elie Wiesel. Tonight's lecture was titled In Hasidism, Reb Labe Sorhiz and His Mysterious Powers. Introducing Professor Wiesel was Rabbi Joseph Pollack, director of the B'nai B'rith Hillel Foundation. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth, with help from Matt Sloan. Our web producer is Angel Cazelli. The executive producer for Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydotes. I'm Deborah Becker. Thanks for joining us.